Yeah, hang on. Let me do the countdown.
Blog Talk Radio.
There you go.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
There he is, and we are live. And there he is, and we are live. Oh, Ron. Hello, Ron. Wow. Did he take him out?
Can you hear me?
There he is. Now I can, yes.
Oh, geez. What is the word here? Oh, man. Okay.
I thought we lost you again.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm starting to do this little, butterfly feeling in the stomach. Like before a big, you start, feeling the same thing.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Whatever. Right now, do not move. Yeah. Whatever you're doing, don't
touch anything. Yeah. Don't touch anything. You know, because if I touch something, it might throw the whole system off. So, we'll do it. But welcome to All About Wine. This beautiful May 18th day. I had to look at it. I've been writing 18 all day long on different things. I still had to check it. We have a guest tonight. In fact, I think he's sitting in the green room right now, enjoying all of our amenities that we offer in the green room. If he doesn't have his mouth full or drinking or something, we'll bring him onto the show talk with him. Hello, Eric. Welcome to All About Wine.
Well, thanks, Ron. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure, believe me. Eric Hemer?
It's Hemer, yeah, long E.
Hemer. Okay. Eric Hemer works for Southern Glaziers, and he's all sorts of stuff down there. I'm going to let him fill all that stuff in. you have been involved with wine for a long time. Basically, tell us, how did you get here? Tell us your story up to this point and what you've been doing in your life and all that good stuff.
How many hours do you have, Ron?
We can stretch it on.
Well, in a nutshell, I've been in the wine business. If you include the restaurant business, the hospitality business, I've been in the business since 1978 when I sold my first bottle of wine in a restaurant. So that's a long time, for 47 years, something like that. But I really got into the wine trade when I went to work for Southern Wine and Spirits in 1988, of course, now known as Southern Glaziers Wine and Spirits, as you mentioned, when we merged with Glaziers of Texas in 2016. So I've held various roles. I was in sales and sales management for many, many years. And about 20 years ago, as the owners of Southern were putting on expanding, when I started, we were in 3 states, and we're in 45 markets across the United States and Canada, and some Caribbean presence as well. But when I started, we're a fairly small organization. We're in Florida, Nevada, and California at the time. But when we really started to expand, the Chaplin family, the principal owners of Southern, decided they should have dedicated educational positions, and I was tagged for that for Florida, where I've always been based in Miami with Southern. And I did that for about 10 years. And in 2013, I took on that same role, but nationally. So I'm now Senior Vice President in charge of wine education for Southern corporately. And
wow.
Along the way, I picked up some certifications. I'm a certified wine educator with the Society of Wine Educators. In 2003, I became a master sommelier with the Court of Master Sommeliers. And in 2013, for me, the crowning achievement was Master of Wine. I was inducted into the Institute of Masters of Wine in 2013. So I think I'm about done with certifications. I don't think I have a stomach for anymore. So.
Well, since you mentioned three, the educator and master, can you tell us a little bit about what it requires to take those and get those certifications?
Sure. Well, let's focus on the top two. Not that there's anything worthy about Society of Wine Educators and Certified Wine Educator, but we've got quite a few of those. Master Sommelier and Master of Wine were multi-year pursuits, and they're very different. The Court of Master Sommeliers, as I think many people know, it's really focused on on-premise, restaurants, hotels, and it's not just about wine. It's about spirits and other related beverages, and it entails not just theoretical knowledge, but the ability to identify wines blind in a very fast, rapid manner, and also service, you know, the service of wine, the hospitality of wine, and all the things that go along with that, you know, very, very important in the Court of Master Sommeliers. And there's several levels that you have to pass before you get to sit for the master level. But it's comprised of three parts, and they're all verbal. So you go into a room, and you have held over a period of days, and you have just a short period of time, 25 minutes, to identify six wines blind, down to grape variety, region of origin, and vintage as closely as possible.
Wow.
Then the theory exam consists of multiple questions, typically around 70 questions, and the examiners just ask you questions, and they can range throughout the world of wine and spirits and related beverage and service. And a lot of it is very, very minute, trivial detail that has to be memorized, but there's a lot of it. And it's, when you're being peppered with questions verbally, it gets a bit nerve-wracking. So, you have to really go in there prepared for this. And then the third part is the service exam, perhaps the most important exam for an aspiring master sommelier, because that's what the court's all about, is, the top-level service in the hospitality restaurant industry. And it's challenging. You have to perform various tasks and answer questions while you're doing it, such as decanting red wine and opening and serving champagne, and the business of the sommelier, doing math in your head. It always helps to be good at that, so you can figure pouring costs and all that sort of thing, table side. So it's a lot of quick thinking on your feet. So that's the Court of Master Sommeliers program. Very, very different is the Institute of Masters of Wine. Coincidentally, both of these programs were London-based originally, and they've really become international programs.
Oh.
But the Institute of Masters of Wine is all about wine, and it's about wine from the ground up. It covers, and it's all written theory, so it's all written exams, the theory, the tasting, and then there's a research paper that has to be submitted at the end. So it's kind of like getting a PhD in wine.
It sounds
like a very, very deep level of knowledge. Yeah, it's a very challenging program. So I was very fortunate and happy when I completed the third and final leg of my Venice Triple Crown, if you will.
Yes. There's limited numbers of Masters of Wine, too, aren't there? I mean, it's not like there's hundreds and hundreds.
There are 400, just over 400 worldwide. The Court of Master Sommeliers is just about 235 worldwide. And then there's only three of us that have both titles.
Oh, wow. Well, wow,
yeah,
that's impressive.
It's pretty rare circle.
Yeah. That's great. But I want to point out, too, that for listeners out there, Southern Glaciers is a distribution and education place. They distribute all sorts of spirits, so it's not just wine they come under. So
that's right.
You know, just let people know that. We were going to talk, one of the first things, and I'm glad we finally got John, because we've been bouncing back and forth for like 3 months now, it seems like, trying to get a time that's good for both of us to get you on here. So I'm glad
right.
you finally made it. One of the things that we first started to talk about was the no alcohol and low alcohol wines and the big upward trend of that right now. And you were suggested by the young ladies that I corresponded with that you are knowledgeable in this area. And I brought it up on a show a couple months ago about this no-low trend that is happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want your input and tell us about it and why and what's going on with this. Seems odd to me. I mean, I don't know. It's just personally, it's hard for me to wrap my
brain around. I get it. Well, we're probably a little bit older. No offense, Ron, but you and I have probably been around the block a few times.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
This is really this is a trend that I think is being driven by younger consumers, and it is definitely growing. I think there's a couple of reasons behind it, and one of the primary drivers is sort of the better for me movements. You know, a lot of people are concerned about what they eat and drink and concerned about their health, and, you know, we know that overconsumption of alcohol is dangerous to your health. And so I think that's sort of the driving factor behind low and no alcohol wines, and it's just sort of part of that overall trend of eating more healthy products, you know, trying to cut out things that are bad for us. But of course, you know, a lot of people really enjoy wine and they don't want to give it up completely. So that's sort of given rise to this whole category. Now, I'll point out that no alcohol wines have been around for a while. Two of the leading brands 30 years ago are still two of the leading brands today. And those are Free by Sutter Home, which you probably have heard of, and Ariel, which is another one. And so they've been around for a while. And I think the trouble is or was with them that they just didn't really taste like wine. And that's been sort of the motivation behind, you know, some of these newer brands is to try to create no and low alcohol wines that are satisfying to people that are used to drinking a glass of wine. As you know, when you remove some or all of the alcohol from wine, you're removing a lot of the body and texture. It's not necessarily just the intoxicating effect of alcohol that people like it for. It also gives body and texture to the wine. even though, you know, let's be honest, you know, a lot of the, you know, the primary motivation is, you know, we enjoy the social aspects of drinking alcoholic beverages in moderate quantities with our friends. So that's kind of what's driving it. And I can tell you, just still looking at no alcohol wines, right now, global value is about U.S. $2 billion.
My gosh.
And that is trending up. It's trending up, and it's estimated more than double in 10 years by 2033 to about $5.2 billion. So
jeez.
It's definitely going to grow. It's continuing to grow, and I think you'll see more and more players entering the market. I think you'll see a lot of the big brands, and you already are starting to see some of this, some of the big producers out there, the international companies entering this category because they see that there's money to be made, and if there's a demand, they're gonna try to supply it. So that's what that's all about, really, for non-alcoholic, and it's biggest here in the U.S. The major companies that are or countries that are consuming these wines are number one the United States, number two Germany, and number three Japan. And I
wow.
think the Japanese, it's interesting because when you hear about Japanese culture and drinking, you often hear about, you know, people drinking way too much wine. But I think there is that growing movement, especially amongst the younger generations, you know, the Gen Zs out there that don't want, you know, to drink too much alcohol. So I think that's why you're seeing that drive. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ron.
No, I just – people used to come into the winery when I had the winery open, and they said, you have non-alcoholic wines. And I'd say, well, I'll go down to Publix. It's called Welch's, and it's sitting right down the shelf. You know?
Right.
I mean, you know? And, yeah. But, the, you know, which leads me to the point, you take the alcohol out of wine, how do you keep all those flavors and stuff in it? I mean, the concept is very difficult for me to understand. What do they do to get the alcohol out?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the problems is it can be fairly expensive to use the technology to de-alcoholize wine. But basically there's three, especially speaking about no alcohol wine. And when we're talking about that or non-alcoholic wine, we should let people know that the standard definition is less than 0.5% alcohol. So, that's just a tiny fraction, but that's the standard here in the United States. But there's three methods. The most commonly used one is called vacuum distillation. And what they do there is in a closed tank, pressurized tank, the wine is heated just to the point that the ethanol, the alcohol in the wine, boils off. And you can take that all the way down to 0.5% or less by volume. And what happens is with a strong vacuum, as the alcohol vapor starts to boil off, and it boils at a lower temperature than water, it is sucked up by the vacuum. And it separates out the alcohol then from the remainder, which of course is water and all the different phenolic compounds that give you aroma and flavor and color. So you keep that without the alcohol. And basically that's how you're able to maintain, the qualities that people like, that wonderful color, the aroma, the flavor, but without the alcohol. So that's the first one. Then the two other methods are a little bit more expensive. One is called reverse osmosis or RO. And this is basically a filtration system. It's used for, water and all kinds of other products around the world, but this is another method that just sort of separates the alcohol molecules from the rest of the wine by putting it through a very, very dense filtration system, and that's expensive. A lot of people have to take their wine to a special, place to do this reverse osmosis, and it's expensive because the cartridges are very expensive membrane cartridges that have to be replaced on a regular basis. The third method is called spinning cone, and this is basically also a vacuum. It's sort of an advanced form of vacuum distillation, which you can think about that with these rapidly spinning cones creating centrifugal force. So it's a vacuum, and it creates this little thin film of wine, which is a faster put through, and it's also lower temperatures. We're talking about 35 to 45 degrees Celsius, and just for a very brief period of time, about 25 seconds, and that lowers the alcohol very effectively. So it's kind of high tech, and that's why you don't see lots and lots of brands, and most of the ones that do it, are large producers that can afford the technology. And that's no alcohol wine. So those methods are also used to create low alcohol wine, and I know you want to talk about that as well. And lower alcohol wines can be defined as between 7 to 9% alcohol by volume. And, as your listeners know, table wine typically runs between 12 and 15%, depending upon the type of wine. So we're talking about half of the typical alcoholic volume. And in addition to those three methods, you can also do it by harvesting fruit that's underripe, has less sugar concentration, and therefore less potential alcohol. So that's one method, and you'll see some of these lower alcohol Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand on the market, like Brancott has a wine called Flight Song, which you may have seen out there, and then there's Kim Crawford's Illuminate. And these methods, these wines typically use early harvest, as well as some of the other technology like spinning cone. So, for example, Kim Crawford will use spinning cone to reduce the alcohol to below 1% on 60% of the volume, and then 40% of the regular alcohol base, at around 13%, and then blending them back together, and you get a final alcohol blend, a volume of about 7%. So that's sort of an ingenious way to lower the alcohol without losing aroma and flavor. One of the reasons people love New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is for that wonderful aromatic intensity
that it
has. Yeah, and then, of course, you can just blend lower and higher alcohol wine together to lower the alcohol. So it's a little bit easier to make lower alcohol wines than it is to make no alcohol wine. But again, one of the rubs. I mean, it's a growing category. But some surveys show that consumers are just often a little bit disappointed by the taste profile that they get in lower alcohol wines. Because again, when you remove the alcohol, you're removing some body and some texture, and not necessarily the alcohol, but it's just, you know. So the same consumers that are going for, you know, de-alcoholized wines or no alcohol wines are also the ones that seem to be driving the market for lower alcohol wines, which is still substantial. It's over $1 billion in U.S. dollars around the world, and it's forecast to grow over the next 4 or 5 years at about 30%. So it's not going away, and I think you'll continue to see more and more brands entering the marketplace. But it's kind of rough waters right now, and I think there's a lot of competition. And, of course, often people expect, wow, there's less alcohol, it costs less now, right? But that's not the case. The retail is about the same as it is on the regular alcohol wines from Kim Crawford or, you know, Brand Cotter or some of the other brands. Meiomi, a very popular California brand, has just come out with a lower alcohol Pinot Noir. It's about 8%. And another factor here, too, that we should really mention is not only are the wines lower in alcohol, but they're also lower in calories. And some producers are even billing it not as low alcohol, but it's low calorie, which is not deceptive, but it's a little bit disingenuous because, you know, they're appealing to people because they're watching their what they're eating and watching their calorie intake, but they don't tell them, it's also less alcohol, too. But, but that's well, a pretty pretty.
Yeah, we've always had these wines that have ranged between, you know, say 8%. They've been out there for a long time. You can find those, you know, in different areas and in different wines, whites, and they tend to be a little bit sweeter and stuff. But you've always had all of this lower alcohol level there. And again, I used to always tell people, a good way to tell the sweetness of the wine is the lower the alcohol, usually sweeter, the higher the alcohol, the drier it's going to be. And I said, that's just a very basic way to look at wine to try to find if you want something a little bit sweeter and all that. But if they're picking them early, then that rule's just down the drain.
Well, not necessarily, because if you look, for example, at, let's take New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, where it's commonly early pick, because they're trying not only to reduce the alcohol, but also to get that really herbaceous, you know, grapefruit intensity that people love. And you're making a dry wine, so you're fermenting it dry, but there's just not enough sugar to get the alcohol up beyond, you know, 10-11% alcohol. So you're still getting a lower alcohol dry wine. But the ones you're referring to, absolutely, you know, German Riesling's probably the most famous example. Wines that range anywhere from 7.5% to 10% alcohol. But the key here is, as you mentioned, they're sweet. So the residual sugar is giving you calories. So they may be lower alcohol, but they're higher in calories. So that sort of, you know, sort of flies in the face of, you know, the reason that a lot of people are, you know, sort of attracted to these lower alcohol wines is because they do like the lower calorie content too. You know,
so
you could look at Moscato d'Asti or other sparkling sweet wines from Italy that are only 5.5% alcohol, but they've got a lot of sugar.
A lot of sugar.
So,
and that's just, and you know, do you think? And this is just, I know your opinion, but do you think it's a trend? I mean, you say in a couple of years we're going to look at 5 billion worldwide, but you know, as anything, it peaks and then it starts coming back down again. You think it's going to happen with this low alcohol and no alcohol trend?
Yeah. I think there's, you'd have to differentiate between fads and trends. And I think, you know, some fads come and go every day, and, you know, not just in wine, but in fashion and all kinds of stupid things that people do. but I think trends, you know, tend to be longer term. And I do think that this is not going away. I think you're going to continue to see this. And, you know, you'll recall the fairly recent backlash against super high alcohol wines. You know, it was common for a while there for Napa Valley producers to be making 15% alcohol wines. But, you know, after two glasses, you know, you're intoxicated. And people have finally said, look, I've had enough. I want to enjoy wine without getting hammered. And plus, you know, it's hard to pair food with wines that are that intense. So I think along those same lines, you're going to see some moderation. And why not? I think, you know, we have the technology. as long as you can, you know, make the wines taste good and approximate what they're used to good enough, people will continue to buy the wine. So yes, to answer your question, I think it's a trend that's going to continue to grow, and I think it's going to be with us. It'll probably level out, just like White Zinfandel leveled out, but White Zinfandel still, I mean, we still sell millions and millions of cases of White Zinfandel a year in the United States. And a lot of people said, oh, that's just a fad. It's going to go away. And it, here we are 45 years later, and it's still with us.
Good, you know, still selling powerful, so many, yeah.
It, exactly. So, yeah, I'm not really going out on a limb. I think I can put my money where my mouth is. I would bet that this is not a fad. It's a trend, and it's going to be with us for quite some time, just like Prosecco, another one that, you know, 25 years ago we had one brand of Prosecco. Now we have, I don't even know how many. I mean, it's probably 50. And they
it's all
sell.
Over.
So,
it's amazing what's happening with that. I don't know. I go back to the millennials and Gen X's and Gen Z's and all that, who are really the ones that are driving this, it seems, more than anything. And as they get older, you still think they're going to continue buying it? Or are they going to transition to a higher alcohol wine too?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the same question every marketing organization in the wine business is asking themselves right now. Because, Gen Z has not embraced wine the way previous generations have, certainly not the way us baby boomers have.
No.
But millennial generation too, not quite drinking as much. So, you know, this is that scary point in the wine industry where people have to decide, you know, what they think the future is going to hold. And it's hard to say, you know, people change. When I was in my 20s, I didn't drink wine because I couldn't afford it. And I didn't start drinking wine until I started working in the restaurant business. And then I started to appreciate it and then realizing, oh, well, it's worth more money than this awful, you know, beer I've been drinking. You know, now I see why people are willing to pay more money for wine, because you're getting more complexity, more pleasure, you know, more food and wine affinities, you know, all the reasons that people do that. So I think, as Gen Z matures and they make more money, they might be attracted to, you know, a higher aspirational lifestyle, if you will. And I think that includes fine wine. I don't think they'll ever drink as much wine as some of the previous generations do. But I do think that as their palates mature and become more sophisticated, they may incorporate, you know, higher quality, you know, higher priced wine into their, you know, weekly repertoire. Although I know young adults now that are in their early 30s that never drank alcoholic beverages for the most part at all, that still haven't really embraced wine. You know, they're drinking cider, they're drinking hard seltzer, the bane of the wine industry, and other things. So yeah, that's a scary term, hard seltzer, when we're on a wine show.
I know. I don't understand.
But, you know, it's really hard to say. But I think I always look at my daughter, who is now, you know, in her late 20s, and she never drank wine at all. But now she's starting to realize that, you know, good wine can really enhance a meal and make even simple meals taste better, you know, by, you know, the addition of something like a, you know, an inexpensive Chianti Classico, which you're going to have for under $20 a bottle, I think. You know, once they get it, then I think they're going to come back and do it again.
And that, yeah, that's very true too. I don't drink no alcohol wines. I used to have the free way back years and years ago, and I think I can still taste that nasty taste in my mouth. and it's turned me off to it completely then. And I don't buy it, because if I'm going to go down, I'm not going to spend money on something that recalls bad memories. Have you had no alcohol?
I've actually tasted quite a few lately, because, you know, I work for a very large distributor, and many companies come to us with new ones to try, and some of them I've tasted, and they're actually pretty good. They're never going to replace the original, but no alcohol wines that I've tasted lately, I think are pretty darn good. And one of them is from the big Cava house, Frejenet. Everybody knows the black label. Well, they've come out with a new line called Leggero, and they make a rosé and a white sparkling wine at about the same price as the regular cava, and it's actually good. I mean, it really tastes like sparkling wine, like cava. Again, on the body, it really still lacks a little bit of that, texture from alcohol. But I think the CO2, the carbon dioxide bubbles, really make up for that lack of texture in still wine. So I think sparkling wine, no alcohol sparkling wine, might have a leg up on still wine because of the addition of the bubbles. The bubbles make up for a lot.
Wow.
But I've had that. I thought that was really good. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll have to try that. Like I say, it's just I've continued this prejudice against the no alcohol wines for so long that it's hard for me to imagine. And I'm sure they've improved, as everything over the years will improve as they work on it. I mean, it's just natural progression. But that sounds interesting.
Even Sutter Home Free, which I too remember, the early the early attempts for them to make a good tasting product. It wasn't very good, but they've done a pretty good job too, and they also have a sparkling wine available, and also in cans, which is a really popular format, single serving cans. So Sutter Home Free sparkling in a single serving can, I think, is going to do pretty well. And their Chardonnay, looking at the Chardonnay, it's up about 20% over last year on a pretty large base. We saw a lot of Sutter Home Free.
Wow.
So I think there is hope for the quality of de-alcoholized and low-alcohol wines as we go forward into the future. So.
And that's the key, I think, is the quality.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm one of those boomers that had that back when they first came out with it, and you went, ooh, and you just never touched it since then. And
right, first impressions,
First impression has hung with me, and you just walk right past the no alcohol section of the store and went to the other store. You mentioned cans. Go on.
Yeah. No, I was going to say you and I are probably never going to completely embrace no and low alcohol wines, but I think we can appreciate them for what they are, and for the target consumer, I think it's a wonderful alternative. And I should also mention, too, that recently I've had Stella Rosa. Everybody's probably familiar with Stella Rosa. It's a very popular wine. It's the number one Italian imported wine in the U.S. in terms of sales. And they also have some interesting no-alcohol wines, too, that are flavored wines. One of their big reasons for success is their wines that are flavored with other fruit flavors, like their Ruby Rosé grapefruits. They've got an orange Moscato and a few others. And I think the addition of that, fruit essence makes up for the lack of alcohol too. But again, they're sweet, and it's not for everybody. It's not for you, Ron. Not for me. But there's a consumer out there that likes this sort of thing, and I think a little bit of sugar covers up, a lot.
it does.
That category too. Yeah.
And that's something I'm finding with the, the Gen Zs, Gen X, millennials, they tend to go for sweeter wines. And because of that, everybody's saying, well, the boomers are buying a lot of the wine. I think the boomers are buying a lot of the reds and the heavier, a little bit higher alcohol, higher tannins and stuff like that, as opposed to the sweeter ones, which is the being carried by the millennials and younger.
I think that's a natural progression. I think as your palate matures, you tend to go to drier and drier wines. And again, I look at my daughter as a sort of test market for that, because like most kids here in the U.S., you grew up drinking sweet fruit juices and sweet sodas and that sort of thing. And as you become more sophisticated and realize that wine and food go together, that's when their palates start to dry out a little bit. And I think you'll see that, with a lot of people. So I do think, going back to our previous point, that as these generations mature, they will at least try, if not embrace, the what we consider wine, dry wine with normal levels of alcohol. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm always reading trade journals and stuff like that in the wine business, and they're always going on and lamenting about the fact that, oh no, when the boomers die, the wine sales are going to drop and all. And I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the younger generation is going to continue and increase their purchase. But I don't know. I may be wrong. But, we'll see.
Yeah, and they're going to need help. I mean, I think education is the key. A lot of almost everybody in the wine business is thinking, all right, how do we convert these non-wine drinkers into wine drinkers? So that's the big thing, I think. You know, making sure that it's available to them, that they can taste wines, you know, doing trade tastings, doing restaurant tastings, you know, education. It's so important to continue to bring new generations into the, you know, the fine wine world, you know, and once they're here, they appreciate it. But it's going to take a little effort to make sure that we have that continuity going forward into, you know, the next couple of decades. So,
and it is very, mine too. It's very important. I mean, I, you know, spread around. I love to see young people getting involved with wine and stuff like that. And, you know, all my grandkids would say, Grandpa, tell me about wine, you know, and it's just, I like that question because, or that comment because it gives me an opportunity to introduce something more than just, you know, here's some soda pop wine and, you know, get away from that stuff.
Me too. I've been teaching at Florida International University and working with their students for 20 years now.
Oh, wow.
So one of the most satisfying things I do is working with young college students that are in the hospitality management programs and introducing them to the, you know, the wonderful nuances of fine wine. That's one of my big passions these days.
Hmm. When I had the winery open, Florida State's winery open, Eckerd College down in St. Pete.
St. Petersburg,
I used to go down there every year and do a presentation on on their week of don't drink and drive and all that, and I'd have me in as a guest and I'd talk to them about wine, and it would they'd have to cut it off at 60 students because everybody wanted to sign up for it. It was just amazing.
Really popular.
Amazing.
And we
talk about
cool.
wine. Yeah, it was. And some students was able, they heard it coming in, and I'd see them like 3 years in a row. And I'd say, were you old enough to drink? And they had to be. They wouldn't let them in the program unless they were old enough. And it was always nice to see them so involved in it and asking questions that were intelligent. And I love stuff like that. That was really, really a lot of fun.
I know, me too. Yeah, you see the light bulb go off, and you're like, yes, I've got them.
Exactly. Right. And you really do see the light bulb.
You really do.
You mentioned something earlier, and I want to pursue a little bit more. Wine in cans, that seems to be growing more than anything right now.
Yeah, well, we can just call it alternative packaging because it's not just wine in cans, but you know, bag and box and Tetra Pak and all these alternatives to glass bottles, even bottles that are made out of other materials, are really popular for several reasons. One, concern for the environment, and the other one, the big one, is portability. You know, you can take a wine in a can, you know, to the pool. You can take it to sporting events, to the beach. I mean, a lot of places that glass is not allowed, you know, these other alternative packages are. And I think that's what's really driving it. And what held it back early on was just low-quality wine. But today you can get very, very good quality wine in all of those alternative packages. So that's huge growth category. But I think that's a topic for another episode. I hear the missus calling me for dinner. And if I don't get to the table before, while my dinner's still hot, she's going to be mad at me. So
I think
we have to call this one for the evening, Ron. So
I
want to thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it has been a great pleasure for me also. And I'd definitely like to get on and talk about some more stuff, like, you know, alternative packaging and, you know, and whatever happened to paperboy bottled wine. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, it sounds great. Hey, let's set it up, man. I'd love to come back.
Okay, we'll do that. I'll get a hold of our Sophie. I think her name
Sophia.
Was Sophia.
Yeah.
Okay,
we'll get a hold of Sophia. Shout out,
And we'll
right,
we'll
Ron.
get you Rescheduled. Thank you for joining us, Eric. Enjoy your dinner, and we will talk to you sometime soon.
Okay, Ron. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Bye now. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
I had so many more questions for Eric. So many more.
Yes. Yep. That's the reality of it. It's, you know,
that is.
Dinner is important.
He's in southern Florida.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I saw the area code and I go, there's no way that's him, because I didn't recognize the phone number and I didn't know he was in Florida to begin with. But then I'm thinking, okay, southern, hello. Are we southern?
He worked for Southern Glaciers.
Yeah.
And Southern Glaciers is joined with, like you said, Glaciers.
Southern Wine and Spirits.
And Southern Wine and Spirits. And Southern Wine and Spirits was Florida, Nevada, and California. Those three states.
Mm.
And they were big in Florida. They were the big dog. I mean, the big dog in Florida as far as distribution goes. And when I had the winery, there is a three-tier system in Florida. In fact, there's a three-tier system in almost every state. You can be a manufacturer, you can be a distributor, and you can be a retail. You cannot hold all three licenses. We had all three licenses. Mm-hmm. Florida State's winery had all three licenses. I think it was a glitch more than anything, but we were able to hold all three licenses. Couldn't transfer them. I was trying to give them to somebody else, and we couldn't do it. But most of the places, you can only hold two licenses. So you can either be a manufacturer, a retailer, or a manufacturing distributor, or a distributor and retailer. And most people went for manufacturer and retailer. And then if you wanted stuff distributed anymore or anywhere, you had to go through a distributor, which was Southern Wine and Spirits in Florida. And I didn't like Southern Wine and Spirits in Florida at all, because they were so big, they would take your wine or whatever it is, and I say wine because that's wine, they take your wine or whiskey or beer or whatever, because they handled everything. They would put it in a store, and they would say, mark it at this price. And then if for some reason it didn't sell after a couple months, or somebody didn't pick it up, because it happened, especially with new products, Southern would go in there and say, okay, reduce it by, you know, 15%. And then they would, you know, then it would sell, but then they would give the people, the winery, the reduced money for the sales without our authorization or anything. They would just want to sell it. So if I normally sold a bottle for, say, $15 at the winery, and they got it and were distributing it, and they put it in the store for, say, $17 so that the store can have a couple of dollars profit, and I would get, say, $13 from it, because then Southern would take a couple of dollars profit. Excuse me. Then if it didn't sell, they would say drop the price. Well, Southern would still get their $2, and the store would still get their $2, but I would then start getting less and less for my bottle of wine, or if I sold beer, if I made spirits or anything else. So it would start cutting into my money and not the stores or theirs. And I'm just using these arbitrary numbers. So it could be substantial. And that's one thing I was not real thrilled about, using a distributor. If people are familiar with your product, then it will sell. If they're not familiar with your product, it doesn't sell well. And that goes for everything, everything on the, you know, you go in the liquor store and most people just gravitate right to their same thing all the time, and they don't vary, which if you're listening to this, vary your purchases. There's lots of great wines out there. But so But the Southern was enormous in Florida, Nevada, and California. Southern wine spirits. Glaciers was in Texas. That was their stronghold there, and they were enormous there. And they're also, what are you saying, in 19 states now? All the southern states and all that is now Southern Glacier because they went in together. And they're a big, big distributor. I don't know if they're in New York or not up in the East Coast any further. I don't know. I don't even want to guess because I'm not sure if they're out there. But they are one of the Southern was a big dog. When they joined with Glaciers, they became a big dog. They are one of the biggest distributors in the country. And because of that, they can dictate. You know, somebody says, I want my product distributed, and they look at it and they say, no, we're not going to handle it. And so then they have to go to somebody smaller, or they say, okay, well, we need, you know, 1,000 cases, and we're only going to pay you this much per case. And you can take it or leave it if you want to distribute it all over the country. You know, I mean, it's just because they're big, they can do stuff like that. And it's good to hear Eric tell me how they're doing other things like education and doing stuff like that, because to me that's more important and a very important step in the distribution aspect around the country, because the way the laws are in this country, and any time you try to change the laws in this country so that you don't have to go through a middleman, you don't have to go through that distributor, because of places like Southern Glacier, and there's like four others around the country that are almost as big, are just as big. Because of those, they are so strong in their lobbies and stuff that we can't get anything changed on a federal level. So I'm done with my soapbox on that. It was a good visit with Eric, though.
So, oh, and it shows they have a North American footprint on their website, and it says territory spanning 45 U.S. markets plus Canada, and that they have a local team. They've got 42 plus distribution centers, 7,000 brands. Looks like 6.4 million customer deliveries annually, and they list all the states and the contacts and everything like that. So 45 out of, what are we at, 52 states? 50 states?
Only 50. <we're> only 50.
Another one.
But we didn't pick up anybody yet. We might.
Yeah. Oh, okay. They list even Alabama and God, there's, what was that one that was having trouble distributing wines?
Alabama, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They have an office in Ridgeland, Alabama. They have an office there, so yeah, it lists all the states and everything. So it's
amazing.
Kinda good.
They're enormous. It's almost mind-boggling how large that they are as distributors. They really are some, and they're one of, I think, four or five. Let me Google spirit distributors.
Utah is another one. They have an office in Sandy, Utah, and I thought Utah was pretty strict too at some point. But
they are.
There's quite a few. They're only five states short of everybody. So, Alaska, they got all kinds of Anchorage. They do have a. This picture is huge. Wow, that's it.
Here you go. Yeah, I just clicked in Spirit Distributors in the U.S., and it says here, U.S. Spirit Distributors looking for distribution. It says six alcohol distribution companies you should know about. Number one here is Southern Glaciers Wine and Spirits. Number two, Republic National Distributing Company. 3 Breakthrough Beverage Group, 4 Empire Merchants, 5 Johnson Brothers, and 6 Allied Beverage Group. And I'm sure every one of those are enormous. Then they have another list here. Boy, every one of these lists, though, shows Southern Glacier as the biggest. This one shows Southern Glacier.
The same thing as Constellation, right? Isn't that similar to what they do? Or
Constellation brand is – Constellation is a wine conglomerate. They just do wines, and they have their whole area of wines and all that. I want to say that Constellation might distribute themselves, but maybe they don't. They might go through. Don't take it yet. I haven't said anything about it. My engineer just brought in a bottle of wine while I was talking to Eric, and I was sipping it. I'm going to tell about it. Payoff is the name of it. It's Alexander Valley Red Blend. It's from 2019, a vintage. And it says, winemaking is a dedication and craft and skill. The variables of the growing season can be incredibly challenging, but the payoff, there you go, of making a great wine is an unrivaled art. Enjoy the fruits of our labor in these elegant, fruit-forward, and vibrant wines from Sonoma County. 14.8% alcohol. Wow. We were just talking about no and low alcohol, and this one jumps up to 14.8%. It's a red blend. It doesn't say the percentage. I hate it when they don't give you a percentage on the back of those. And they don't have a phone number here either, or else I would call them right now. But it is a nice purplish color. Moves you into legs. Legs are pretty decent, rather slow. Getting berry aromas. Surprisingly, I'm getting a little bit of black licorice, which I hardly ever pick up, but this really does give it on this. Oh, the alcohol got to me right away on that sip. Almost too much alcohol. It seems to overpower some of the flavors on there. But it's got some good fruitiness to it. And high alcohol, oh boy, you know, when it's this high, I refer to it as being hot. This really is the high alcohol. You can taste alcohol, which makes the wine tend to be, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of this. Like Eric just talked about, California went to this high alcohol phase a few years back. Oh, it's been quite a few years back now, 20. And when they did that, they were making red wines that were into 17, 18, I saw a couple at 19%. And people went, whoa, wait a minute. All you can do is just burn your throat on these. If we want a whiskey, we'll drink whiskey. We don't want our wines to be that way. We want to taste the fruitiness. We want to taste all that other stuff. And so they backed off, and they came back down to, you know, lower alcohol. Another thing on alcohol, too, once it hits 17%, the government taxes you at a higher level. And so you'll see wines that are below 17% simply because once they hit that 17% mark, it becomes, well, like ports and sherries and all that. Those are higher, and they are taxed at a higher level. So, but it's good, but hot. It's that high alcohol, you know, high.
See, it feels like acid to me.
I can understand what you're saying, because that high alcohol gives that little burning sensation in your throat, you know. So, but Payoff is the name of it, out of Sonoma County. It's a good wine. I was talking about the alcohol, but it's very good. It's got some nice, berry flavors to it, and the aftertaste is pretty good. A lot of tannins in it too, and I like the tannins. I'm a tannin fan, and there's tannins in this also. So, except for the higher alcohol, it checks all of my boxes. So before she came in, taking it, says this particular article I just discovered is top 14 wine distributors in the United States. This is USA Wine Ratings by Beverage Trade Network. excuse me. But this is a pretty good site. Well, I've never discovered this before. It has wine reviews, insights, news, wine and food, travel interviews, videos, podcasts, grapes, producer profiles. Let me click on save this as a bookmark. Okay. But the first one here, Southern Glaciers Wine and Spirits are America's largest wine and spirits distributor. It was founded in 1968 in Florida. It then expanded from Florida to California in 1969. It provides services to 36 states and 1,178 wineries as per Wines and Vines and Analytics. As per Forbes magazine, the firm generated $16.5 billion in sales in 2016. It sold 150 million cases of spirits and wines in 2016. So that's obviously the last date. So probably higher in 20 and 21. Headquartered in Miami, it serves 36 states, has 126 offices. U.S. Wine News represented 1,178. Chairman is Harvey Chaplin. Vice chair is Bennett Glazier, CEO Wayne Chaplin, and the president is Sheldon Stein. So there's the rundown of Southern Glaciers Wine and Spirits. They're the biggest one by far in the United States. Republic National Distributing is next. Breakthrough Beverage Group, then Young's Market Company out of Tustin, California. There you go. Breakthrough is in New York, and the Republic is out of Grand Prairie, Texas. I've heard of Republic. I think Republic is in Florida also. So is Breakthrough. I've seen them. Johnson Brothers Liquor, Heidelberg Distributing, Wine Warehouse. There's another one located in Los Angeles. They only cover California. But they do quite a bit of business, though, just in California. Cover 104 domestic wineries and rank 7th as a wine distributor. So, wow, one state. Martignetti is next. Empire Merchants is located in Brooklyn. They serve 3 states right up there in that area. Winebow Group out of Virginia. Frederick Waldman out of New York. There's another one. Allied Beverage, New Jersey. Moon Distributors in Little Rock, Arkansas. And that's top 14 there. So, a lot of distributors, a lot of different distributors. And Eric works for the biggest one in the country. Impressive, I have to say. Southern Glacier. Southern. I used to always just call them Southern. Now they go by Southern Glacier. I don't know when they merged. I think he said they merged in 16 or something like that. So.
2016. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 2016. Was one other thing I was going to mention tonight, and I forgot what it was, and I guess it wasn't important. No, I guess not, because I can't see it laying here, because I always leave myself notes if I'm going to talk about something, and I have no notes. So, okay, well, I guess we are finished for the night.
Wow.
Just, so, yeah, it's a good guess. I will get him on again. I will talk to Sophia.
Yeah.
And she was our contact. And I will get him on again because I want to talk to him about canned wines and box wines and paperboy. And it sounds like he, remember we talked about paperboy, what was it, a couple of years ago, I think now, about the bottle that was going to be a paper, wrapped in paper, made in paper, not just wrapped, but actually made in paper. And we talked about that, and then it just disappeared. We never heard anything more about it. So it sounds like he knew about Paperboy. So definitely have to get him on again. It was interesting talking with him. But boy, I'll tell you what, though. You got to give him a more than a just, I well. For his knowledge and for his passing those two tests. Oh, my gosh, what? The Master of Wine and the Master of Sommelier, only three people in the world hold both of those titles. And he's one. That is just amazing. So.
Yep. Amazing accomplishment. A lot of work.
Yes. Okay. Speaking of a lot of work. And a major compliment. We always have to give a shout out to Mike's show.
Oh,
flightline.com or org.
Flightline Radio. Yeah, flightlineradio.com.
Yeah. Okay, I knew I was forgetting something. Flightlineradio.com. He is live, still Friday nights from 7 to 9. He's thinking about changing that, but when he does, I'm sure he'll let us know. But the Flightline Radio is on all the time, playing all sorts of music and, you know, just all everywhere on what they're playing. It's not just one type or one style or anything. You can listen to it, and all of a sudden the song will pop on. You go, oh, I know that, and you'll sing along with it and stuff. So, you know, tune into him live. What's that?
I said, or turn it off completely. It's just, nah, I don't really like that.
Yeah, I just turn it down and listen for the next one. He will be on live, though, tomorrow from 7 to 9, and he takes requests, and he chats with you, and he does, you know, private messaging chat, and he'll take your request, and he also has his own thoughts about lots of stuff that he'll bring up and keep you entertained for the 2 hours. So definitely tune in and listen. You can always put it in on the background. What I've been doing is Friday evening, sat down, putting it in on the background and doing stuff on the computer and just listening to him. And it's always interesting. So flightlineradio.com.
Thank you. Yep. Tune in.
Don't have to register or anything. Just tune it in.
And we run ads for the wine show, of course. We do that. I think they're on every hour on automation.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's usually 15, 20 minutes or so. There's different ads, but I think there's only two running right now. So you hear three songs an hour, and then the promos. So, thank you. What time is it? I don't even know what time. I don't know what monitor to look at.
8:04. 8:04?
Yeah, 8:04. Yep. Unless you're on the other monitor, and it's 8:03. So,
yeah, there you go.
Thank you all.
On my phone, I think that says 8:05 now. Yeah, I just, you know.
Yeah. We'll be back on next Thursday, the 25th of May. That's the last show of May. Wow, it's going by fast.
Wow.
At 7 p.m. Eastern time. Yeah. And we'll be back then. So thank you all again for tuning in. Have a great week and weekend ahead. And take care. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, and be safe.
Yeah, thank you. Be safe.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine,
All About Wine.
With your host, Rome. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on the show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archive shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
All About Wine. Always miss that second All About Wine on the closing.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I don't know why, but it just sneaks up on me.
Yeah. Yeah, we're off there. Okay, let me go into the little green people room. Yep.
Turn it. Green people room.